Welcome to The Drummer's Pathway, the podcast about music, life, and the creative process.
Hello, I'm Michael Scott, and welcome to The Drummer's Pathway podcast. This episode features part one of my two-part conversation with drummer Nate Morton. Based out of Los Angeles, he is the highly regarded drummer for the house band on NBC's The Voice. Previously, Nate was the drummer for the reality series Rockstar in Excess and Rockstar Supernova, and was also part of the house band for The Bonnie Hunt Show. Nate has also worked with such diverse artists as Paul Stanley, Cher, Vanessa Carlson, Natalie Cole, Miley Cyrus, Madonna, and many others. As a graduate of the Berklee College of Music in Boston, he has become a respected educator and loves to inspire others to find joy in the pursuit of music. In our conversation, we discuss how he found his passion for music early in life and how his determination to become a professional musician has led him along different paths that allowed him to establish a successful music career. We also talk about why it's essential to value and find joy in the opportunities that are available to you. Now, let's get started with part one of my conversation with drummer Nate Morton. Whenever I've had the opportunity to see you perform, not only is there a high level of professionalism and precision in your performances, but there's a sense of passion and joy that is absolutely infectious that I have always found to be inspiring. So where did that passion for music come from in the first place?
That was really funny. You put me on the hot seat right away. I thought you were going to be like, today I'm sitting here with drummer Nathaniel Morton. And da, 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 da. And I was like getting in my mode. And you were like, bam, you came out firing. I appreciate that. Yeah. So, you know, I started playing drums, Michael. I was 5 years old, 4 or 5 years old, banging on pots and pans. And what I often say to people is, I'm pretty much still 5 years old, banging on pots and pans. I mean, I mean, you know, I consider myself a bit of a caveman in that regard, in the sense that drums to me is, obviously we deal with complex rhythms and complex polyrhythms and, you know, the technology involved in making a drum and making cymbals, et cetera, et cetera. But it's not that far removed from the very first time someone picked up a stick and hit a log with it. And so I really like that about drums, and it enables me to remain in that very kid-like five-year-old headspace. So when I'm playing drums and you think to yourself, wow, he looks like he's having fun playing, just know that in my head, I'm a five-year-old caveman. Just know that. That's the reality.
Well, and I think one of the things that often happens when you turn a passion into a profession is that I know a lot of people have lost an element of joy in the things that they do, because there's that challenge at some point during your career where you have to make a living. And then suddenly your priority now comes to filling the calendar rather than finding joy in everything that you do. And I think that's one of the things that I have noticed about you, is that you never really seem to have lost that joy. Now, saying that, one of the things that I was really curious about is that I'm sure if you look throughout your career, there has been many opportunities and many situations that you've been put in where you were presented with music that was the last thing that you actually wanted to play, and you had to reach deep inside in order to find that passion and that joy in order to make that performance exceptional.
You know, it's really funny, Michael. The truth is, and this is the truth, from the very beginning, I always wanted to target, or whenever possible, select projects that involved people that I enjoyed playing with, playing music that I enjoyed playing. Now, playing music that I enjoyed playing, that's not a hard target to hit, because the reality is I enjoy playing most things, most music I enjoy playing. I'd be hard-pressed right now to come up with something and go, you know what, I really don't like playing. I really don't like playing fill in the blank, right? Now, am I a jazzer? No, I'm not a jazzer. But when I have the opportunity to play jazz, I look at it like an opportunity to A, experience something that I don't often do, and B, get better at something that I don't often get an opportunity to get better at. If I get called to play whatever gig I get called to play, I sort of take a little bit of enjoyment and a little bit of pride in being able to do it convincingly enough that I don't get exposed, you know? And so marrying that to sort of the first idea, which is that I seek out musicians I like, I seek out music I like, I've made decisions at times where I've chosen a gig that paid, you know, I've got gig A and I've got gig B. And gig A doesn't pay a ton of money, but I love the music. And gig B pays more money, but I know I'm going to pull my hair out. And I've chosen gig A time and time and time again. And my feeling was always, as long as I allow that to guide my career, if you will, then this is the way that I thought about it back then, like in my, let's say, 20s, right? As I'm kind of starting to find my way, I thought to myself, as long as I allow myself to be guided, not by money or financial gain, but by music I like and musicians that I like, well, if eventually I come to a point where that equals financial gain, I'll look around and I'll be playing with people that I like, playing music that I like. And so in that regard, I've been fortunate. Now, like I said before, me finding music that I like is not hard, because my worst day as a musician, or as a drummer specifically, my worst day as a drummer is better than my best day doing anything else.
I think that one of the things that I also have found really interesting about your process so far is that you grew up in a household that had a passion for music, but was not musical. Your parents weren't musical, but your dad, I think you've often said that your dad played the radio.
That's correct. That is correct. And your assessment is an accurate one. They didn't play. Now, it's funny. I wouldn't say, I understand exactly what you mean. I did grow up in a household that was musical by virtue of the fact that there was music always playing. But I didn't grow up in a household with parents that played and constantly surrounded by an entire family that played. No, I didn't. I was a little bit the outlier where that's concerned. But I would definitely have to say, I have no choice but to credit the fact that my father was always playing music with my, you know, I have to give that credit, you know what I'm saying? Because my enjoyment of music had to come from somewhere. It had to be influenced by something. And so I think that that had a lot to do with it. I think that my earliest influence, Animal from the Muppet Show, had a lot to do with it. You know, I think that going to see, at the time, my parents lived in Nashville, Tennessee, and they would go to see their alma mater, Tennessee State University. They would go to see their football games. And the marching band at Tennessee State University was incredible. I think that had a lot to do with it. So those would have all been things that I would have been experiencing when I was 5 years old, 6 years old. You know, those kinds of things. Those were some of my earliest musical influences. So to your point, no, neither of my folks played, but I definitely think that in one way or another, they definitely had an influence on my earliest musical beginnings.
And you started formal study as a drummer around high school age, correct?
Just before high school, yep. My last year of middle school, I would have put it maybe eighth grade, seventh grade maybe even, because I knew that I wanted to join the marching band when I went to high school, and I felt like I needed help getting something together, getting my skills together so that I could do that style of drumming, approach that. I played drum set, like I said, from the time that I was five. But yeah, formal lessons on drums, not until maybe the end of middle school.
Now, were you a music major throughout high school?
We don't have majors in high school. Well, at least the high school that I went to didn't have a major. The opportunity to do something musical in high school would have been an elective. So I would have chosen band as my elective. And in doing so, that comes with different avenues. For example, if you're in band as your class, your elective, part of the season, or part of the year rather, you have marching band season where you're going to competitions and you're competing against other high schools, or maybe you're playing your high school's football game that Saturday or whatsoever it is. Other parts of the season, or of the year rather, the academic year, we were playing, you know, we're doing concert band. So we were competing with other concert bands. Other parts of the school year, we're doing jazz band, you know. So that was as much as you could sort of be a music major. So no, I wasn't really a music major. Cause I don't think that there, I don't think we had, I know that we didn't have that. And I'm not sure what high school looks like today because that was just so long ago for me.
Well, and I think it really just depends on sort of the path that you're taking. A lot of times when people are in a high school situation, they take music because they're required to take one credit of music.
Sure.
And from there, some people find that they're more on the academic path or the athletic path. For me, I think if it wasn't for music and the arts, I think I would have been completely lost through my whole high school experience. One of the things that really gave me was an opportunity to participate in an ensemble situation where I felt like even though I might not have stood out on my own, I felt like I had value because I was part of a community.
Well, my community was, and I say this in a loving way, and I very happily place myself in this category, nerds. My community was nerds. My community was nerds. My community was like, if you were to look, like, you know what a Venn diagram is, where you have, yes, the two circles and one represents the other. So if you were to say one of those circles is academic nerds, all the math kids and all the science kids and whatever, right? The kids who play chess, you know, during lunchtime, right? And then the other circle is music nerds, right? The intersection of those two, that was my peer group. My peer group was made up equally of academic nerds and music nerds, and I took great pride in that. And it was a lot of fun, you know? And being in high school, that was the first time that I was ever in a band. And so that was the only thing that made me even remotely cool. Was that my band in my local high school, Acamilli, you know, it was like, oh, it's the guys from Acamilli. So that was fun, you know. But other than that, man, I take great pride in being a band nerd and an academic nerd.
Post high school, you went on to study mechanical engineering because it was sort of determined that it's always good to kind of have another path to fall back on.
Let me stop you right there, Michael. I don't know if I would say, I don't know if I could call what I did, quote unquote, studying mechanical engineering. There was a brief period in my life when a form rolled across my desk and I had to write what I was majoring in, and I wrote the term mechanical engineering, but I think I probably would have had to have passed more classes and would have had to have stayed in it longer. But yes, do continue. I apologize. What's up, man?
We all have courses and things that we have taken because there was no prerequisites required in order for us to enroll in these situations. But as you said, a lot of times when you're at that point, you kind of have to make a decision. I was feeling a little lost in high school, and I had a really good guidance counselor that I had talked to about what path to go into. And I told him I wanted to study music. And one of the things that he said to me was that I was very fortunate in my situation because he knew that I had parents that would support any path that I had chosen, and not everyone is always blessed to do that. So I made the choice to study music at a post-secondary level. You went into mechanical engineering to start, but I do know that you quickly switched majors and then eventually switched schools and ended up at the Berklee College of Music.
True. All of that is true. All of that is true. I enrolled at the time in what I thought would be a marketable program should I, you know, wash out as a musician. But I realized very quickly that under no circumstances did I ever really have any intention of being a mechanical engineer. And one of the key red flags was the mandatory attendance of 8 a.m. Monday, Wednesday, Friday engineering calculus. And that was one of those classes where at the beginning of the season, I keep saying season, I think about TV. I have TV on the brain. At the beginning of the year, the professor says, look at the person to the right of you. Look at the person to the left of you. One of these people will not be here at the end of the year, you know, and turns out I was one of those people not there. I was the person to your right that was not there at the end of the year, you know. And so I realized that you can't half-ass your way through a mechanical engineering major. That's not a fluffy major that you can just sort of sail through. You really have to be committed to that. You really have to put in a lot of hard work. And my level of commitment to that was so low that I couldn't bring myself to do it. So I had to make a choice and I had to make a change.
And why Berklee?
That's an interesting question. The short answer is probably because my longtime drum instructor, Grant Menifee, went to Berklee. And you know what? That's probably the simplest answer. Occam's razor. My drum instructor went to Berklee, and I had then and still do have a large amount of respect and just there's a great amount of importance then and now in what Grant says to me. So and the knowledge that he shares with me and had shared with me then. And that was probably the primary reason. And Grant is honestly the reason why I even found myself going down the path of being a professional musician. Because one lesson, Grant looked at me and said, you know, I don't tell a lot of guys this, but if you really worked your butt off at this, you might be able to make a living at it one day. And I was like, that's amazing. So even as a even as I'm enrolling in my mechanical engineering classes, essentially at that point, as that is happening, in my head, I'm thinking, okay, can I just blast through 4 years of getting this degree that I can then put on my shelf and never look at ever again, and then begin my life in earnest as a musician? You know, that's what I was. That was literally my mentality. And as I said before, and I'll reiterate, you can't really I couldn't complete a mechanical engineering degree with that mindset.
One of the things that has made Berklee such an in-demand and exceptional school for many is that it's a really big focus on the contemporary aspect of music. So looking through your experience at Berklee, what were some of the most profound lessons that you learned? Not necessarily in a technical musical drumming sense, but in terms of some of the skill sets that you learned that are most valuable to you as a professional musician today.
That's interesting. I will say this, when you sort of began to shape the question, I immediately flashed to an encounter that I had with one of my friends at Berklee. And this particular friend, kind of in passing conversation, said, "You're a good player, but you're really cocky. And that's why more people don't call you." So when an elder or a parent says something like that, you're like, "You don't know. What do you know, old person?" But like when your peer tells you that, it's a little bit like, "Whoa, okay, let me check that out. Let me make an adjustment here." So that was one of the lessons that I learned. If I could oversimplify, the lesson was like, "Hey, buddy, how about some humility? Like, how about you chill out?" And I mean, that was, like I said, that was a really valuable thing to me. That was a very valuable thing. And it's really interesting listening, thinking back to it now. It was the exact right thing to be said by the person who delivered it to me. He was the exact right person to say that exact right thing to me at that exact right time. So that was one of the things that I learned from being in that environment. The other thing that I learned is Berklee, aside from the invaluable musical education, and by the way, I have nothing but great things to say about Berklee. I mean, it's expensive. Okay. All schools in Boston are expensive, you know, but in terms of the education and the exposure to different players, instructors, styles, gear available to you in terms of recording and so on. And then even Boston as a city with its museums and parks and things of that nature. And then if there's anything that you don't like about Boston, Boston's, you know, nephew across the Charles River, Cambridge, or as we used to call it, the People's Republic of Cambridge, has all of it. You know what I'm saying? It's like, so just that entire experience, being at Berklee, meeting those people, players and instructors, having those kind of influential moments in my life, and just being surrounded by incredible musicianship on so many different instruments in so many different styles. I mean, it was really quite something.
Well, you studied with a number of different faculty members when you were there. How were those lessons profound in terms of the things that you learned from that perspective as well?
Before going to Berklee, there was a drummer in Baltimore that I knew. And if memory serves, I could call his name wrong, but I think his name was Chris Webb. And I heard him play one night. I was playing at his jam session or something, and then he played, and he was incredible, and he had really great Latin chops, like really, really great Latin chops. And he was a little older than me, and I struck up a conversation with him. He explained that he had gone to Berkeley. And I said, oh, is that, you know, where you developed your Latin playing? Yes. Oh, who did you study with? Ed Uribe. Rest in peace, Ed Uribe. And so going into Berkeley, also too, funnily enough, Ed Uribe and Grant Menifee were best friends. They went to Berkeley at the same time, right? So it's all like this kind of meant to be kind of thing, funneling me towards Ed Uribe. So going into Berkeley, I felt like I want to improve my Latin playing. When I hear guys do that stuff, I don't know what they're doing. What is that? So I set a course for Ed Uribe. So that was my first couple of semesters. After Ed, I kind of felt like I'd love to get my jazz chops together. So I found myself studying with John Ramsey, who's an Alan Dawson disciple. And after John, I studied with Ian Frohman, who was also a jazz, you know, jazz drummer, but kind of a different slant. And I learned a lot of things philosophically from Ian as well. So as with my private instructors, so too were the classes I enrolled in. In other words, I sought the classes that I thought would give me certain skills that I wanted to gain. So when I had the opportunity to take Studio Drumming Lab, that wasn't necessarily a requirement, but that was something I wanted to know about and something I wanted to learn about. A school like Berkeley is very much like a smorgasbord, if you will, or a buffet. There we go. Let's do it that way. A school like Berkeley is like a buffet. And so if the same person goes through that same buffet line, the items they choose from that buffet can be quite varied. If I don't like spicy food, but I really do like sweet food, then I'm going to skip straight to the desserts. I'm going to eat all dessert. Whereas, you know, you dig what I'm saying? So yeah. The resources are there. Their resources are there. The instructors are there. At the time, the library was there. It's still there. I just haven't been to it. But at the time, I would spend a bunch of time in the library because they had a vast amount of live concert DVD and VHS tape, right? We're talking about multiple decades ago. VHS tapes, and you could check them out, and you could sit there and watch them at the little audio video desk or whatever. So it's a place, Berkeley is a place where if you have an idea what you want to get out of it, it's all there. You just have to find it.
I think that's one of the biggest challenges that many had is not necessarily the lessons that they have that are given to you and the opportunities, but rather finding the discipline in order to take everything in that's being presented and actually really get that benefit. Because I know, you know, a young student in college, it's hard to find that discipline.
Well, and you're hitting on a broader topic even, but you are not wrong. I was very fortunate that I did kind of have a clue about the kind of player that I kind of wanted to be. So I sought, as I said before, I sought the resources that I had hoped would make me into that sort of player. Yes, you can go there. And if you don't have an idea what you want to be, then you're going to get the same thing that every other person who goes there that doesn't have an idea what they want to be is going to get. And then that's where a school can sometimes get this cookie cutter idea or this assembly line idea. Berkeley, to me, does not have that. There are other schools that do. Berkeley is not one of them, as far as I'm concerned.
Now, post-Berkeley, you moved to L.A. Now, did you move to Los Angeles with a plan or with a dream?
Yes, that's the answer. I felt like when I finished Berkeley, and there was a lag time between finishing Berkeley and moving to LA. I finished Berkeley in 94, and it wasn't until 1998 that I moved to Los Angeles. During those 4 years, I was playing full-time in Boston, various wedding bands, cover bands, etc. When I moved to LA, I basically looked at it like this. At the time, I was in Boston, and I was driving around sort of looking at houses because a couple of things. Number one, I was fortunate to be busy, and so I had a couple of dollars, and I'm a drummer, so I wanted a place where I could set up drums and make noise. So I'm driving around, and I'm looking at houses, and then it dawns on me, it just kind of... By the way, I need to point something out. When I teach, I start my lessons by saying, all the information that I share with you is simply information from my perspective about what I did and what the end result was in my life. It is not me saying this is the way to do it, nor is it me saying, quite frankly, it's not me saying I'm right. I was right when I did this. No, I'm just telling you what happened. So I'm driving around looking at houses, and it dawns on me, and I kind of go, I'm not sure that I've practiced hours and hours a day from the time that I was single digits years old, and I went to Berklee College of Music so that I could buy a house in Jamaica Plain and settle down and be the most in-demand cover band drummer in Boston. With all due respect to in-demand cover band drummers in Boston that live in Jamaica Plain. I, however, did not feel like that was the reason why I had done all those things. So I was like, okay, I need to probably make a decision here and make that move and at least try to make an effort to achieve my dreams. Now, to your point, I did have sort of a plan. Now, let's talk about how I landed on LA. Living in Boston, I was not fully committed to being a straight-ahead jazz player, nor did I ever want to see any more snow. So I crossed New York City off the list. Even though there were other styles around, the dominant style in Nashville was country.
Yes.
It still is. And so because I didn't want to play 85% country at the time, I crossed Nashville off the list. I landed on LA and I thought to myself, if I have to live somewhere and struggle for my art and be broke, it might as well be somewhere where it's 85 degrees and sunny every day. And that's what drove me to LA. And that's how I landed in Los Angeles, California. So, yes. And then to your point about having a plan, you know, I mean, I had a loose plan, which was basically you call everybody you know who could have any influence on getting you a gig in any way, shape, form, or fashion, and you let them know that you're in town, and you say, I don't have a gig. And you hope that some opportunity arises. That's kind of the way you do it, or the kind of the way I did it anyway.
Now, when you moved to LA, what was the first kind of bigger opportunity that came your way?
The first big opportunity that came my way when I moved to LA was playing jazz fusion at a whisper quiet level, driving about 2 hours from my house out to San Bernardino to play at a restaurant from 6 o'clock to 10 o'clock. Now, you may think that I'm joking. I am not, because at that time, that was the biggest opportunity that had been presented to me. And to me, when I looked at my calendar and I saw it spotted, you know, with those things, Tuesday I'm playing, you know, jazz at a nursing home. To me, in my head, I went, okay, you moved across the country. You live in Los Angeles. You have gigs on your calendar. You're an LA musician. So that was a big deal for me. Now, to take your question as how I know you intended it, one of the first auditions I did was for a singer named Billy. And I went and I found my way to the audition because I had called several people and a couple of people had given my name to this particular guy named Barry, who was organizing the audition. And so Barry called me and said, well, we've probably already got a guy, you know, we got a bunch of people coming, so we're probably covered for drummers, but you know what, why don't you come on down, play anyway, we'll get to meet in person, and then, you know, we'll just go from there. I said, okay, and I jumped at the chance, and I was very fortunate to get a call back, and then, you know, at the end of the callback day, I wound up landing that gig, and so that was a gig that included a lot of TV shows, because at the time Billy was a new artist. So when you're a new artist, you're on all the TV shows. You're on Conan O'Brien, you're on Leno, you're on all the morning shows. Playing with Billy Myers was the first, thinking back on it now, was the first opportunity that I had to play on TV shows, I do believe. So that would have been sort of a milestone event. You know, ooh, I'm playing a TV show. Wow. I used to watch Jay Leno on TV, and I would think to myself, when a band would be on and there'd be some drummer playing there, man, if I lived in LA, I could have had that gig, you know, and now here I am and I'm playing on the Leno show and I live in LA, and that, you know, so that was a big deal. From Billy, one gig sort of just led to the next. And, you know, it never felt like, sometimes people ask me the question and they say, hi, how did you know, when did you know you had made it? When did you know you had made it? And my patented comeback is, I'll let you know when it happens. Like, I don't feel like, at no point in my career have I ever felt like, I've made it. You know, even now playing on The Voice, I don't necessarily feel like I've made it, because I feel like the second you start to think I've made it, then you relax and then you don't continue to push as hard and you don't continue to work as hard on all aspects, you know, in terms of playing wise, as well as in terms of continuing to foster relationships with people and so on. So, yeah.
I've been very blessed over the years to have studied with some pretty renowned people. And one of the things that's a really common element in all of them is that they're not done. They have a passion for learning. They see things that are currently not within their grasp that they want to reach out for and achieve that, to see what's behind that. And they keep pushing themselves. And I find that desire and that passion to constantly learn and push yourself doesn't create frustration, but rather creates excitement and joy, because you know that you're never going to run out of experiences and opportunities.
100% agree. 100% agree. I just started doing something the other day, and you know, I had a student say to me, we work on like Gary Chafee exercises, right? Yeah. So I don't know how many of your listeners are drummers or other musicians or have nothing to do with music, but I was working out of a Gary Chafee book with one of my students, and they said, do you ever try to play these exercises open-handed? And I said, not really. But I said, you know what? Let's go one step even further. Let's play it completely left-handed. Let's put my left foot on the auxiliary pedal of the double kick pedal and play open-handed. So now I'm playing truly left-handed. And that's my latest quest. But it tickles me, because I would see my students and I would assign them these things out of this Chafee book, and I would see them sort of struggling, and like the light bulb is sort of just flickering, and then slowly the light bulb comes on and they get it, and I would be like, yes! And I kind of went, I want to have that again. I want to have that again. And so now I'm playing through all of my earliest material left-handed. But it's fun. I chuckle to myself. I was doing it earlier today before getting on with you.
I remember I bought a couple of method books that were written by Peter Erskine. I think I got Volume 2 and Volume 3, and I like to have a complete set of things. I went out and found Volume 1, which was really a beginning drummer book. And I decided, well, I could probably read through this whole book in a half an hour, but that's not going to teach me anything. So I literally put the book on the music stand and I played everything open-handed, and my left hand went on the hi-hat, and it felt really uncomfortable. And then by the time I finished it, it felt unbelievably satisfying to know that you've developed a skill set. And I find, for me, one of the things I often find is that you put time into something and you don't always see the immediate benefit, but then sometimes years later, a circumstance or situation comes up where you suddenly realize that stuff that I worked on 20 years ago suddenly is now applicable to the opportunity that I have now. I've just started doing a lot of work with, you know, playing in pit bands for orchestras for student theater, and they often, because of budgets, don't have a percussionist. And so now, rather than just leaving the percussion out, I end up playing a lot of percussion stuff with my left hand because I like the challenge. So just adding those other things, to me, it takes things that may seem simplistic and actually makes it a challenge that pushes you even harder in order to try and achieve that next level.
Absolutely.
One of the things that I have often found for me is that if I look back at my career as a teacher, I'm a very different teacher now that I'm in my 50s than I was when I was just out of college. How has your approach as a teacher changed over the years?
That's now. So I believe I'll fill your listeners in on something that we had previously discussed, which is that I enjoy it when someone asks me a question that I've never been asked before. So that's a question that I've never been asked before. So thank you for that. Definitely. Awesome. You know, so when I first started teaching ever, would have been like when I was around college age. And one of my jobs was that I taught at a music school called Acton Music School. It was a store, but in the back they had a few instructors' rooms and so on. So there was a guitar instructor, bass instructor. I happened to be the drum instructor. And at that time, I was teaching young kids, probably between the age of 10 and 16. I don't think that I had any adults on my teaching roster at that point. And I found that in that regard, now this is going to be a multi, this is going to be a multi-splintered sort of answer. So in that regard, I pretty much had kind of a regimented plan. I pretty much was like, I'm not going to let you at 10 years old determine your drumming fate. I'm not going to let you, for example, tell me that it's not important to incorporate your wrist when you're playing single strokes. No, no, of course it is. I'm the instructor. I'm telling you it's important to incorporate your
Absolutely.
So at that point, I was driving the bus. I was entirely driving the bus. So then, flash forward many, 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 many years to fairly recent history. And as I'm teaching, many of my students, quote-unquote students, I say quote-unquote students because they're not 12 years old. They're probably my age, give or take 10 years or so either side, right? So they're adults. So in that context, I do sort of allow them to sort of steer the ship a little bit as well. Now, that being said, there's a balance. I spoke to my, as I said to you earlier, very influential on me, drum instructor Grant Menifee. And I said, hey, Grant, when you teach students, do you have like the Grant Menifee curriculum? Like this is what I'm giving to all my guys and making sure that this is what they got in terms of knowledge and education? Or do you kind of custom tailor it per person? This is my jazz guy. This is my gospel guy. This is the guy who, you know, refuses to learn how to read music. This is the guy, right? You know what I mean? And he said, I have the Grant Menifee curriculum that I give to all my students. And he further explained, I do this because that guy who might be 25 years old and in a rock band today, who knows where that, you know, where my band, 80-inch TV screen is going to get signed. And then if 80-inch TV screen doesn't get signed, now where are you? You want to make a living as a drummer, but if you don't have any other skills other than playing in your rock band, good luck, right? So that's why Grant said, that's why I teach guys how to play a bossa, how to play samba, how to play these other jazz rhythms and so on. So this actually hit home recently because I just posted on my socials a performance that I did with an artist named Leve, and she is Icelandic. And the song that she performed was a bossa. Had Grant Menifee or someone else, but Grant Menifee in particular is where, you know, where that started to take hold. Had he not put that in my bag of tricks back then, I might have had the skill set to have done that. Now, as I said, it's a bit of a balance. So now where I am with my younger guys, I tend to drive the ship a little bit more. I tend to be the captain. With my guys who are closer to my age and older, or you know, around my age, adults, I still do the same thing. I still do kind of nudge them, and I still do go, hey, let me show you this bossa. Let me show you this mambo pattern. But at the same time, too, they can come to me and go, hey, man, my cover band is playing this song. Here's me playing it. Watch this video of me playing it. What are your thoughts? We have lessons like that. How would you break down this fill? How would you chart this? How do you write charts? And so I definitely allow more leeway with my older guys. So it's definitely a mix. In terms of how my teaching has changed, that would be the answer. There's an interesting thing that I'm finding happening with my mentality, though, which is that every time someone asks me a question, Nate, why do you do this? Or how did you develop that? Or whatever. I actually have to ask myself this. I'm like, huh, how did I develop that? A good example would be bass drum technique. Nate, how did you develop your bass drum technique? And I'm like, huh, that's interesting. Because at no point in my life did I ever sit with me in a room and just a bass drum and go, thud, 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 thud. I never did that. That was never, ever a part of my, you know, my learning, my teaching, my education. However, at one point, I was struggling with and really working on getting together my samba. Okay, so what's your samba? Okay, once you get it together, you want to push the tempo. So you want to be able to go oof, da-doof, 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 while you're going sa-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da-do-da So as I'm working on the coordination to get my hands and my feet together and to play it faster and all of it, I'm also actively working on my bass drum technique because I'm improving my ability to play those fast doubles. So then when I play two hands, two feet, the technique is there from the hours spent working on my samba. So that would be an example. That would be an example of a question that someone asked me, and I was like, huh, when did I or how did I develop my bass drum technique? So there's been a lot of self-discovery, you know, where I've had to analyze my own playing or my own motivations or my own method to developing whatsoever I developed.
Along that lines, because I think one of the things as you get older as a student is that there is a lot more self-discovery and honest reflection in terms of the challenges that you have. What are some of the challenges that you're still encountering in your own playing, and what are you doing to overcome them?
Interesting. I don't know if I necessarily have challenges in my playing per se. However, there are things that I am working on. So, for example, as I mentioned earlier, working on those chafy patterns left-handed. I don't really have the intention to necessarily set up my drum set left-handed and go and try to do a gig that way. And I don't have the intention of becoming Simon Phillips, where I can play everything this way and that way. However, every now and then, I do try to throw in a little double bass lick. I try to go, right? So if I want to do that, my way kind of actively working on strengthening my left foot is playing all this chafy stuff backwards. It just so happens, it's very much like a combination, kind of like the samba, how I mentioned it a second ago. And in the one regard, you are actively working on your samba, but you're kind of passively just working on your double kick, like not double kick as in two pedals, but yes, two kicks at once in row on the same foot. So in a similar way, when I'm working on chafy drum set grooves left-handed, my left hand is maybe playing 16th notes now on the hi-hat. Maybe that's my ostinato that I'm working on. My left hand isn't usually playing 16th notes. So that thing is getting developed. That up and down wrist motion that we play when we play our hi-hat is happening in my left hand, right? My time is getting better because I practice all that stuff to a metronome. My right hand, frankly, is getting stronger because of my two hands, my left, my right hand can go ding, 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 ding. And then what's your left hand do primarily? Clack, 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 right? So it tends to be that my right hand can do lighter things faster but is less powerful than my left hand, which does lighter things not as fast but is stronger. So I'm kind of trying to balance the scale. And at the same time, passively or actively, I'm working on my double bass drum technique because even though I'm not playing double kick patterns, I'm working on my off foot, if you will. Right. Yes. So to your point about challenges, I mean, those are some of the things that I'm working on now, some of the things that I'm trying to improve in my playing. I don't know if I call them challenges as much as I just call them just sort of things that I'm, you know, inspired to work on lately. I go through phases where it's different things. Sometimes it's chafy and things of that nature. Sometimes I'll come up with some hand-foot combination and then I'll go, oh, wait, how many notes was that? Oh, that was 7 notes. Interesting. And then I'll work around that and I'll see if I can come up with some kind of fill to play. So maybe there'll be that one day.
When you're working with your students, how much does the mindset or the mental challenges come into play that you have to help them overcome?
I suppose it depends on the student. That is not necessarily a cookie cutter answer because of my different students, different players have different mental challenges. So in the case of some of my younger guys, maybe who don't have a strong degree of confidence, there's a lot of cheerleading that goes on. I do a lot of cheerleading. You know, I had one student and we were working on the bottom triplet. And so I said, hey, play the bottom triplet in your right hand. Second, you know, right in playing it. And I say, now here's the most important thing. While you're working on the bottom triplet and you're playing right foot, foot, right foot, foot, right foot, foot, take your left hand and point the drumstick to the sky. You know what I mean? So it's things like that that kind of get people out of their sort of uncomfortable situation where they feel like, ooh, I don't know. And I make them laugh and I try to get them to just kind of loosen up. So that would be one little thing. I have other players sometimes who, for them, just playing in front of anyone is a little bit of a embarrassing is the wrong word, but they feel pressure. They feel nervous about it. And so I always tell all of my players, and I'm going to sound like I'm making this up, but this is the God's honest truth. I always tell all my players, I say, listen, I would rather have, my two priorities are this. Number one, I want you to have fun doing what you're doing, because the vast majority of my guys and girls are not full-time players. They're adults. They're accountants. They work in IT. They work in human resources. So I say to them, the only reason for you to do this is because it's fun. You don't make a living doing it. So the only reason to do it is because it's fun. So my first priority, make sure it stays fun. My second priority is try to share good information that's going to help you improve as a player. And sometimes that information is something about technique or chops or whatever. Sometimes that's a tour story, or sometimes that's a how do I approach auditioning. But I want to give you good information to make you as good a player as you can be. And the reason why I say it in that order, fun first, information later, is because I'd rather have 10 players who suck, right, but love to play the instrument, than 10 guys who burn but hate playing. You know what I mean? So that's kind of how I approach it. And I'm speaking somewhat, you know, hyperbolically. Sure, I'll say that's a word. Judges, ding. Okay, got a ruling on the court. Works. I'm speaking in somewhat hyperbole, but it's the truth. And so that's how I approach it. You know, that's how I approach it. Sometimes it's about getting someone out of their shell. I also have devised certain, I'm going to call it caveman style methods to break things down super simply. Sometimes it'll be as easy as, like, if a player is playing a groove. Now, my drum setter is set up here, and so it's there, so I could, in theory, play. So, for example, maybe I've got a guy, and they're a beginner, and they're playing this groove. That's the groove, right? And the tricky advancement from that is it's not just this anymore, right? You got to get that 16th note on the four, a one. And so maybe I'll sit with someone and I'll go, okay, well, look, here's the motion that's happening right there. At the end of that bar, it's a hi-hat with your right hand, it's a left hand on the snare, and then it's a hand and foot together, hi-hat, kick together. Give me that. Give me right hand, left hand, right hand, and right foot together. And we'll sit there. Two, three, you know? And we'll do it forever. And I'll challenge him. I'll be like, okay, do it 8 times in a row correctly. You know? Do it one more time so I know it's not an accident. Okay. So then they do that. And then we'll just add an 8th note at a time, and eventually we'll manage to build the whole groove. Now, I've chosen a very simple example, but even in a more complex example, that's what I do. And I kind of loosely call it caveman style, because I do kind of take notes and values out of it. And I'm talking pure body mechanics. Mm-hmm. What limb is striking what instrument where in space? Not necessarily even in time, just in space. So, you know, that's one of the things that I do. I mean, that when someone has sort of a block, that's kind of how we get through it. And I have similar things depending on what the block is. So that's what I meant when I said it's not a cookie cutter thing, because different players have different challenges in different areas. So it's not a one size fits all for me.
That was part one of my interview with Nate Morton. Stay tuned for the next episode for part two of our discussion, where we get into detail about working on the Voice and Rockstar series, his perspectives about finding success in the music industry, and working to find balance in your life. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the Drummer's Pathway podcast. Please share and subscribe, get the word out, and let's keep the discussion going. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.